Hey, everybody, welcome to the First Thursday podcast brought to you by the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS, and I'll be your host over the next hour or so as we talk about interesting legal developments in the world of public safety labor relations. We've got five cases this month. No interviews, it's just me talking about cases. The five cases are all different, but they raise, I pick them because they reflect questions that I get every day in representing. Public safety unions. And here are some of the questions. What are the limits on fitness for duty exams? What counts as protected union activity? Does a high test score entitle you to a promotion? What happens when a longstanding past practice conflicts with new contract language? Or what if it conflicts with old contract language? And who gets to decide all this stuff? Like, these are real world questions that I get all the time. I got five cases from all across the country that answer those questions. At least for this month. So stick around, join me, and we'll take a trip across the country. Before we dive into the cases, quick reminder about what we have coming up here at LRAS. We got a couple of seminars coming up in June and September. June is our Rights of Police seminar. They're both going to be in Las Vegas. The June seminar is a lot of fun. It's soup to nuts, contract rights, statutory rights, constitutional rights of law enforcement officers and law enforcement labor organizations. That's a lot of fun. It's 2.5 days. Come and see us there. And if you can't make June, come on out in September. It's a new seminar, Union Leadership in Action. The idea is lots of folks attend our collective bargaining seminars, and we spend a lot of time and effort and energy in negotiating contracts. We don't spend as much time, I think, enforcing the contracts. And so this talks about, you know, not just the grievance process, but other ways that we can enforce contractual rights. And that's maybe through exercising other statutory rights or through political action and things like that. If you're interested in coming to those seminars or our bargaining seminar in October or our discipline seminar in November, just check us out at lrs.com/seminars. And if you want to stay at home, you can get some on-demand info at our webinars page, lrs.com/webinars. Quick note, we just did an FLSA webinar that was like our biggest webinar ever. A lot of people signed up for it, lots of good questions. And the guy who spoke at that, Ryan Hancock, who's a lawyer who does a lot of these cases in lots of places, is going to be in person in Vegas speaking at our Rights of Police seminar in June and at our Union Leadership and Action seminar in September. So check out the webinar. If you like what you see, come on out, see us in person, see if we can get you some answers to those wage and hour questions. Okay, let's get to the cases. Our first case is a federal case. It's a decision that was decided about a month ago by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. That's kind of the Midwest part of the country there, Illinois, Ohio, those types of places. And it's called Nuwara versus Cook County, right? So we're in the Chicago area. And, you know, this is really, this case poses the question of when a fitness for duty exam can become an ADA violation. This happens a lot. And it's an interesting take on this case. I think the lower court decision answered a question that I thought was more interesting, but the circuit court opinion is also helpful. And the person involved here is John Nuwara is his name. He's a correctional officer in Cook County. About 20 years on the job, a little under 20 years on the job, had some trouble at work, some arguments, some confrontations between him and the supervisor, between other employees, with an HR person. And this wasn't just one incident. There were kind of multiple incidents. I mean, nothing rising to the level of, you know, use of force or anything like that. But there were enough red flags raised by the guy's behavior that the sheriff's office took him off of active duty. Basically, they sat him down. They put him on paid leave, and they said, we're not going to bring you back to work until you've cleared a fitness for duty exam. And specifically, we're worried about your mental health. Now, you guys know, listening to this, we have a very high incidence of post-traumatic stress in public safety world. We spend a lot of time trying to encourage police officers, firefighters, and correctional officers to acknowledge that those types of injuries are real. They're as real as banging your knee, right? They're real injuries that can be treated and should be treated. And if they're ignored, they get worse. And so we see a lot of that and a lot of good employers that may try to get out front of issues. If someone is indicating symptoms of PTS, employers maybe, you know, look at this as a way to try to get somebody some help before things get worse. But unfortunately, not every employer is a good employer. And when you talk about, maybe stigmatizing somebody as having a mental health issue, or digging into their medical records, people tend to be, I think, rightly concerned about that. So where do we draw the line? In this particular case, with this particular officer, the county says, we're concerned about your behavior at work. We're going to put you off on paid leave, and we want you to go see our doc and get a return to duty, a fitness for duty exam. And when they do that, they give him basically a HIPAA release form, and they want him to sign these releases, have his doctor sign a release to open up any of his medical records so they can give those to their third-party doctor who's going to conduct the fitness for duty exam. That was the idea. Nawara said, "I'm not doing that. Why do you expect me to release all of my confidential medical information from my primary doc or any other docs that I saw for you to dig into my background? I don't really want to go to this fitness for duty exam, but if you want me to go talk to somebody, I'll do it. But, have that doctor, decide whether I'm fit or not. Why do you need to know what any other doctors have said?" That was essentially the gist of this back and forth. Some of that's in the case. Some of that is just my experience in dealing with variations on this exact same case. These are concerns that we get from people. He holds out for a while. He doesn't get the exam. He runs his paid leave down. At that point, his paid leave transitions to unpaid leave. The county says, "You're not coming back until you've had a fitness for duty exam, and you're not getting a fitness for duty exam until you've completed this HIPAA waiver so that we can access your medical records." He hangs out there for about 4 or 5 months. He actually took another job in the interim, but finally he gave in. He signed the waiver. He went and got the fitness for duty exam. He passed the fitness for duty exam and he was returned to work. Okay, what's the problem? Well, he got back to work and he sued the county, right? He filed a discrimination charge under the Americans with Disabilities Act and ultimately wound up suing the county. And it was an interesting claim. He argued that, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, an employer can't require a medical exam. It can't require an employee to complete a waiver related to the medical exam unless it's job related and consistent with business necessity. And in his view, this dance that he had to go through, that the sheriff's office made him go through, didn't meet that standard. And so he sues the county, he sues the sheriff, he sues everybody, makes it past motions to dismiss, summary judgment. The case actually goes to trial and Nawara wins. The trial court judge determined that the department did violate the ADA by requiring the fitness for duty exam and by demanding these broad medical disclosures. Now, there's language in the Americans with Disabilities Act that speaks specifically to medical examinations and inquiries, and that's section 12.112D. Everyone got that memorized? Of the ADA, and it prohibits improper medical examinations and inquiries. I get this a lot. Where an employer says, "Hey, fill out this waiver, open up your lifetime of medical treatment so that we can conduct an additional exam." And people are hesitant to do that. And the lower court, essentially, in Nawara's case, indicated that this broad waiver of release all medical records was too broad and wasn't tailored to this particular job or particular job requirements. And so if it was a more tailored HIPAA waiver, might that have survived the scrutiny? Perhaps some employers will do a thumbs up, thumbs down version where you go, you have the fitness for duty exam. The employer never gets any of the medical information. All they ever get is like a thumbs up or thumbs down from the doc, whether the person is able to come to work or not. And if the doctor is given a list, an accurate list of the job duties and the requirements, courts will likely look at those things and say that that exam was job related and consistent with business necessity. In this case, it was pretty broad. And I think that that's, and ultimately that's why Nawara was successful in the lower court. On appeal, what Nawara wanted at the lower court was basically seniority. He got his back seniority, but he didn't get any money. And that was because of the lower court's interpretation of the ADA as limiting money damages to situations where somebody was discriminated against because of a disability or because they were regarded as disabled. And the lower court determined that this section 1212D really dealt just with medical examinations. And if there were problems with the medical examinations, that in and of itself didn't constitute disability discrimination. Nawara appealed to the appellate court, and the appellate court, the Seventh Circuit, sided with Nawara. The Seventh Circuit basically reversed the lower court, and it said that the statutory language of the ADA doesn't limit back pay to people who are actually disabled. And Section 12.112D, says that the prohibition on disability discrimination specifically includes improper medical exams and inquiries. And so, essentially what the court said was, forcing somebody to submit to a fitness for duty exam without a valid reason is by definition a form of disability discrimination, even if that person isn't disabled. Make sense? Right. So unless you've got a reason, just making somebody sit for a fitness for duty exam or return to work exam is a form of disability discrimination. A lot of people who listen to this are working in agencies where they do exactly that. Right. So that's a potentially significant decision, and it's a potential big shift in a lot in how a lot of people read the ADA. The Seventh Circuit, talked about that in the decision. There's a great quote, where the court said, look, Congress can define discrimination on the basis of disability however it likes, right? And here it chose an expansive definition. And so the mere act of requiring somebody to submit to that exam per the Seventh Circuit, in this case, constituted disability discrimination, under the ADA. There also were some other arguments in there regarding seniority because the guy had taken another job. But the big uptake from this case was that Mr. Nawara got a lot of back pay for the cover for the period of time that he was out. And we have this standard in the Seventh Circuit that's a lot more expansive. And so, why is it important? Why are we talking about it? Because fitness for duty exams are used a lot by public safety organizations. They're used by a lot of organizations, but particularly public safety groups, right? We have to make sure, because of the important work that police officers and firefighters and COs are doing, that they're able to do the work, not just physically, but mentally, right? In industries where we know there's a high incidence of traumatic stress. And so again, employers might, take steps to make sure that people are operating mentally at a level appropriate to do the job, are going to ask people to sit for fitness for duty exams more frequently than you might see with civilians. In some instances, they're warranted, but the Nawara case is a reminder that these exams are also invasive and they're legally risky if they're not clearly justified, right? So the ADA doesn't just protect people who we identify as disabled. It protects everybody from an unjustified medical exam or an overly broad medical disclosure, and some kind of indefinite gatekeeping, right, that might delay their return to work. And so what does it mean for, our union organization listeners? We got to get a better understanding or some understanding in your agency of what are we doing with fitness for duty exams? What do our SOPs say about whether and when and how we're providing for fitness for duty exams? Are we tracking that? Can we track, how they're being used, who's being required to sit for exams or not? Is management documenting in these instances the business necessity? And is management promulgating these very broad release forms that might go beyond what's needed? And my rule of thumb here is, for every person who pushes back out of 10 people, there's 9 people who didn't. And so there's other versions of Nawara in Cook County that probably just signed the waiver, agreed to protections that were below what the law provides for them. And so that's the union's job to push on that. And his takeaway here is just don't just assume that someone's, not disabled or because they're not disabled, they can't and they don't have a case under the ADA, because in this particular instance, Officer Nawara did exactly that. He won an ADA case when he wasn't disabled because of an overly broad medical release. Our next case takes us to one of my favorite states, maybe my favorite state. We're going to go to Montana, and we're going to go on the highways of Montana. And we have a Montana Highway Patrol case involving a union president, a leaked report, obey now, grieve later, lots of this fun concepts that we deal with. And so, this one sits on the crossroads of union rights and management authority and the boundaries of what we call in this business protected activity. And so the case name is Montana Highway Patrol versus Montana Fraternal Patrolmen Employees Association. It was decided by, it's an arbitration decision. The arbitrator's name is Jeffrey Jacobs, and it was decided in April of this year. The main player in this case is Alicia Bragg. She's a trooper with the Montana Highway Patrol. More importantly, she's the president of the Montana Federation of Public Employees Troopers Unit, so the union president for the troopers. And at some point in 2024, Bragg was placed on a committee called the Strategic Improvement Committee. And it was like this internal working group formed by the Highway Patrol to review a climate survey of troopers. Apparently, the patrol did a climate survey of troopers. Like, what do you think? That was it just like, oh yeah, everything is great here? No, right? They did a climate survey and there were lots of answers, and they put together a committee to review the survey responses and figure out, how can we come up with ways to improve the organization, right? How do we address morale and leadership and compensation, et cetera, et cetera. So of course we're going to have a union person, or you should have a union person on that committee. The report issued by the committee was significant. It was a 37-page report. It included lots of anonymous feedback, right, from people, kind of copied in there directly from the rank and file. Some of it was sensitive. According to the state, anyway, it was all sensitive material for internal use only, pending a leadership review. And one of the heads of the committee, Major Braun was his name, sends the summary to all of the committee members in March of 2024. And he makes clear in the email, do not disseminate this report, right, unless expressly authorized. All right. So already, where this case is going. The union president did not follow that instruction. She emailed the report to her personal email, and then she kind of shared it with the rest of the union, because it identified, some concerns that they had had, and ultimately some of the information in the report was released to the press. The shit hits the fan, right? The press reports some of the findings of the story, which confirms concerns that the union had been raising for some time. And what do you think happens? The bosses go nuts. They launch an investigation. They interrogate the union president. During the interrogation, she says, yeah, that she did send the report to herself. She didn't specifically say, yeah, I shared it with the union, but she did say that she had emailed herself the report. The patrol finished their investigation, and a couple of weeks later, they fire her, and they fire Bragg, one, for insubordination, for violating. There was a direct non-disclosure order when they sent that report to all the committee members. She violated that order. And they also said that she lied during the investigation by, it was dishonesty by omission, right? So there was some information that she left out, which could just mean she knows how to answer a question. By the way, police officers are trained in answering questions. You only answer the question before you. Investigators ask better questions. Anyhow, the state basically said that the chain of command is extraordinarily important, right? Especially in a paramilitary agency, and it is, and that when you're given a direct order about information handling, you have to follow it. That's it, done, right? And that as a result of leaking this report of not following the order, the community's trust in the Highway Patrol was undermined, and the agency's reputation and ability to handle sensitive information strategically was damaged. And that was how they attempted to justify the termination at arbitration. The union didn't see it that way, right? The union, faced with clear disobedience, right? We have an order that says do one thing, and the president did the other thing. They acknowledged the disobedience, but they said this case isn't about that. It's about protected activity, right? That the union and the union president has the right to do certain things, regardless of what she may or may not be instructed up the chain of command. And according to the union, this climate survey dealt with, core bargaining topics, working conditions, morale, pay, all of that stuff. And sharing that information with union leadership and with union members constituted what we call protected concerted activity. And that's under Montana's labor law. And that would be the true, the case under federal labor law, under the National Labor Relations Act. And when Bragg sent the report to herself and shared it with her colleagues. She was wearing her union hat, not her trooper hat, right? She wasn't just acting as an agency member, she was acting as a union representative. And the union also argued, hey, this isn't secret information, and Montana has a pretty strong constitutional right to know right. There's lots of a very strong public transparency provision. And they said this stuff is taxpayer info anyway. Anybody could ask for it and they'd have to disclose it. That was kind of an extra throw-in that they made. The union also argued that Bragg was truthful during the investigation. She didn't reveal additional information, but she wasn't placed in position to do so. And that it was pretty clear to the union that the investigation was biased. And there were specific questions during the interrogation of the union president about whether Bragg, quote, cared more about the union than her fellow troopers, close quote, right? So that suggests anti-union animus. And it wasn't just about the leak, right? It was about something more here. The arbitrator ultimately sided with the union, with Bragg and with the union. The found that the state did not have just cause to support the termination. In fact, the state didn't have just cause to support discipline at all. The first thing he did in his decision was he acknowledged that Bragg did technically violate the order, but he noted that the context mattered. The context was very important in this situation. Bragg wasn't just a member of a particular committee. She was there because she was the union president. That was her role in the committee, was to represent the union's interest inside this process. And therefore, the content of the report itself, was something that the union had a right to know about anyway. The union had a right to see, as it dealt directly with working conditions of bargaining unit members. The arbitrator cited in decision precedent that, and this is pretty clear precedent, that allows union representatives to obtain and disseminate information relevant to bargaining. Most of the folks listening to this podcast are in a state where your organization has a right to information necessary to engage in bargaining and to enforce your contract. And that's exactly this sort of stuff, right? So even though we weren't in negotiations or we weren't, in a specific grievance proceeding, the survey that we're talking about, this report, addressed those same concerns. It addressed morale, compensation, leadership, et cetera. This is information that the union certainly has access to. And the third thing, we see this a lot of times in discipline matters, is this idea that the union president, should have, or should the union president have obeyed that non-disclosure order and then grieved it later. Said, okay, I'm not going to disclose this. I'm going to file a grievance saying that, the bosses have subjected me to an improper restriction and litigate it that way. Obey now, grieve later is something we hear a lot. And the arbitrator found in this particular case that doesn't apply when the employee is talking about exercising union rights, asserting rights that are specifically protected by statute. And in fact, he made clear that union officials aren't required to suspend their advocacy in the face of questionable orders. And I agree with that. We see this sometimes in like gag orders in an investigation, where they call somebody in, they're investigating misconduct, and they say, okay, you're not allowed to talk to anybody in the agency about this. Well, I can talk to the union, right? Or the union steward. And whenever employers try to apply that rule to prohibit conversation with the union representative or to limit a union representative from conducting an investigation, that's routinely going to be dinged by labor boards as improper action because you're interfering with protected and concerted activity. That's essentially what the arbitrator said here, right? They fired a union president for sharing information, for engaging in an act of protected and concerted activity. Even though, yeah, there's a technical violation of an order, it does not rise to the level of discipline. So the arbitrator determined that there was not just cause for any discipline at all, and he ordered that Trooper Bragg be reinstated with full back pay. That's a big, big win for the union. And I know people in Montana were very concerned about this, and a lot of folks are very pleased with the outcome. So congratulations to the union. And look, we move on, right? Just because we have a big win, a big political win, employers, it's okay. It's not the end of the world. Let's just do a better job at trying to balance those rights here and understand that there is a chain of command, but when somebody's wearing their union hat, you're lateral. The chain of command goes away and everybody's at the same level. That Montana case stands for that proposition. For our third case, we're going to stay up in the north. We're going to be in Minnesota. And the case is Humphrey versus City of Minneapolis. It's technically it's Humphrey versus City of Minneapolis Civil Service Commission. It was decided earlier this year by the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and this involves promotion and misconduct and due process, specifically due process. If you're interested in that stuff, come on out and see us in November in Vegas when we talk about discipline and procedural rights and discipline. We'll also talk about that in June, I think, at Rights of Police. And so this case is about how much process, right? How many rights you really have when you're on a promotional eligibility list. What are you really entitled to? And what happens when a department suddenly pulls your name off of the list? The officer in question's name is Christopher Humphrey. He works for the City of Minneapolis Police Department. He was a patrol officer. He put in for promotion to the rank of sergeant in 2022. At the time he put in, he was under investigation for an alleged serious off-duty incident that happened after a training event. The allegation was that basically he got liquored up, he passed out, service weapon may or may not have been unsecured. Not really good. It was at a department-sanctioned event with trainees present. There was an internal investigation into this. These are just allegations, and so we're not taking a position on, what happened there. But let's say serious allegations, during this period of time that this particular officer is seeking to be promoted. While the investigation was pending, the department allowed Humphreys to take the exam. They didn't prohibit him from taking the exam. And he placed well, of course, right? We wouldn't be talking about it if he hadn't placed well. He places number six. So he's pretty high up on the list. The list was going to be valid until mid 24. Over the next year, they start making their way down the list and they're promoting sergeants, and Humphrey's waiting. His time is coming up. And in September of 2023, right when he's on the doorstep of getting promoted, the city unilaterally removed his name from the list. They didn't tell him about it ahead of time. They didn't give him a chance to be heard. There was no notice or opportunity to be heard. They just cited a provision in the civil service regs in Minneapolis that says that the city can remove a candidate from a promotional list if their employment record is, quote, unsatisfactory for any cause which could impair the safe, efficient, and effective operation of city service, close quote. So they have, it's pretty vague, but they also have language in there that gives them the right to pull somebody from a list. What did Humphrey do in response? Well, he appealed. All right. So he filed an internal appeal that goes up, starts with their HR director and makes its way up to the Civil Service Commission. And during that appeal, it showed that the review that the reason he was pulled from the list was this alleged misconduct at the training event. They went through some of the evidence there, which wasn't particularly helpful to Officer Humphrey. And so if we were looking at the merits, maybe there might be cause to do something. But at the time the decision to remove Humphreys from the list was made, the department hadn't finished its investigation. They hadn't disciplined him at all. They hadn't done anything. So there was just an allegation. And that's what makes the case interesting. We have an internal file. We have some damning evidence, in the investigation. People might, pretty much assume that they know how it's going to turn out, but it hadn't turned out yet. However, based on the state of the investigation being conducted by the police department, the city's HR director concluded that Humphrey's record was unsatisfactory and that the city had the basis to remove him from the list, notwithstanding the fact that there's been no formal discipline imposed. The Civil Service Commission agreed with the city and they upheld the decision, again, without any kind of full hearing. Humphrey sued, and the case made its way up to Minnesota's Court of Appeals. And Humphrey's made, two primary arguments on appeal. One was that the removal from the eligibility list lacked any substantial evidence supporting it. So substantively, right, there was no reason to remove him from the list. And the second argument, which is what the court, I think, addressed more interestingly here, was that his removal from the promotional eligible list violated his right to due process, right? He was deprived of a government benefit without any notice or an opportunity to be heard, right? That's pretty basic due process, right? We all kind of live and work in the public sector here on this little podcast, and we all know about notice and opportunity. Humphreys probably has a pretty good case there. Nope, he did not have a good case. The appellate court rejected both of his claims. Why did they do it? All right, let's talk about that. So, Minnesota law says that administrative decisions have to be supported basically by reasonable evidence. It's, the quote is, such relevant evidence as a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to support a conclusion. All right, so it's like just something that a lunatic, maybe only a lunatic would disagree with. That's my version of that law. The court said that the bar was pretty easily met, and the what the court keyed on was during the investigation, which was not yet complete, Humphrey had admitted to drinking and to engaging in some misconduct. So even though there hadn't been a formal completion to the investigation, the evidence in there, Humphrey's own statement, essentially admitted misconduct, and there was photographic evidence and other things corroborating that admission. The court just, wasn't swayed by the fact that there no formal discipline had yet been imposed, and the court said that the rule didn't require discipline; it only required evidence of unsatisfactory conduct, right, that could impair city operations. That was what was required in order to pull somebody, from a list. Evidence of unsatisfactory conduct, not a conclusion that there was unsatisfactory conduct. The court basically said sleeping, drunk, next to your gun at a department training event was unsatisfactory. Here's the quote. The rule does not require discipline before the city can remove a candidate from the list. Officer Humphrey's employment record shows that he engaged in the conduct in question prior to his removal from the list. Close quote. That was enough for the court. So prom run is done. How about the due process argument? All right, substantively they might have you, but here they just like remove the guy with nothing. Humphrey argued that when I'm placed on a promotional list, that gave me some type of property interest protected by the Constitution. And if that's true, then the government, it follows the government can't remove him from the list without due process, without some type of hearing or some type of meaningful opportunity to respond. And the court said, nope, not so fast, right? And they cite a bunch of cases that say that a property interest isn't created by a mere expectation, right? You need a legitimate claim of entitlement grounded in law or contract. In this particular case, we're talking about a promotional list governed by civil service rules that give the city ultimately discretion to select who to promote or not, and discretion to remove candidates for, any good reason, essentially, per their rules. So while Humphrey may have had a subjective expectation of promotion, or a subjective expectation of staying on the list, the court said that that's not enough. And the language of the rules didn't create any type of entitlement. Instead, all that the civil service rules created was discretion on the part of the city. And here's what the court said about it. Quote, an applicant's expectation of promotion based on test ranking or prior employment fails to rise to the level of a property interest entitled to constitutional protection if the employer may consider subjective and objective factors in making promotional decisions. Basically, what the court said, there's no entitlement, so there's no property interest, and there's no due process. The court did acknowledge some of the procedural weaknesses and how the city handled it, right? They could have communicated these things a lot better. But ultimately, the court said none of that matters, right? The way that the city notifies somebody or doesn't notify somebody doesn't really matter if there's not a property interest at stake. And here there wasn't a property interest at stake. And so, why does this matter for folks on the union side? Promotional processes are always difficult. They're always contested, right? Somebody's losing. If somebody's winning, somebody's losing. And it's almost a no-win situation for the union because, if bargaining unit member A is promoted over bargaining unit member B, somebody's happy, somebody's unhappy. We should never operate under the assumption that once you're on a list, you're protected. There's always going to be, and systems are going to change, but there's always going to be some type of discretion. And that's why we're talking about this case. It's a good reminder that eligibility does not equal entitlement, right? So unless your contract or your civil service rules say otherwise, and some do, right? They require you have to promote by seniority or whatever your contract may say. If your contract doesn't have those types of protections, then the department can pull your name. They can do it quietly, they can do it permanently, they can do it politely. But they can do it as long as they follow their own rules. And so, what do we need to know, I guess, from the union point of view is know the rules. What are the rules in your jurisdiction? How much discretion does your employer have, whether that flows from the contract or whether that flows from your civil service rules or a state statute or et cetera? Make sure you understand how hard you can push or how hard you can't. and let that treat your treatment of complaints filed by employees. I don't love this decision. I know that you don't have a right to be promoted. I would suggest that under those civil service rules, you do have a right to be considered. And I know that the parties did kind of make those arguments, and maybe they'll continue to make those arguments if the case goes higher. I do think there was a due process violation in this case. I don't get to decide cases. I just get to talk about them or argue them. But I do think that employers, even though they have the right here, should tread lightly. I always say with employers, and this is basically, these are Loudermill rights, essentially. Why wouldn't you do it? If you're going to pull them from the list anyway, you have the right to do it. Let them know, hey, we've decided we're going to pull you from the list. We're going to give you a week to change our minds. Show up, have the meeting, let the guy say, I don't think it's fair, and say, okay, we heard you, and then do what you were going to do anyway. I mean, isn't that kind of what employers do? And I would argue, well, that's not real due process, but that's a whole different story. Here, the employer didn't do anything. I would suggest that's probably not a good way to go. But in this particular case, employer wins. The officer was rightly removed from a promotional eligible list. Our final two cases relate to each other. They're two past practice cases, and they're both East Coast cases. One's a New York case and one's a New Jersey case. What's a past practice? What isn't a past practice? Actually, we've done a webinar on that. We could do a whole day on that. In September, when we talk about enforcing the contract and we spend a lot of time on like the grievance process, we spend a lot of time on past practices. What are they? Are they enforceable or not? And we spend time talking about them because they're confusing, and they create a lot of issues, on the ground there in labor management. And so I want to give you two examples of past practice arguments. One went the union's way, the other didn't. Both involve contract language changes. And so we're going to start in New York in a case out of Albany, the County of Albany and Albany County Sheriff. You can let me know if I mispronounced Albany, if I should say Albany, whatever. It was decided by New York's Public Employee Relations Board, the PERB. The citation is 57 PERB 301. This involves deputy sheriffs in Albany County. Pretty typical, I think, deputy sheriff bargaining units. Some are going to be in the courthouse, some are going to be out and about doing other things. The deputies in this instance assigned to the courthouse had a more typical kind of Monday through Friday work week that matched the court's work week, a little broader hours, but basically a Monday through Friday work week. And so if you were a deputy sheriff and you were assigned to the courthouse, and the courthouse is closed on state and federal holidays, you're good to go, man. You're just getting your regular paycheck. You're not using a holiday. You got paid, and it was just one of the perks of being assigned to the courthouse. And some people don't like being assigned to the courthouse. They would rather be out in the street, but this is one of the benefits of being assigned to the courthouse. There's no dispute that this is how they did it. This was baked into the culture. There's no misunderstanding about the practice or not. Deputies, supervisors, civilians all treated these things as this is guaranteed time. You don't burn any leave. You get paid for the holiday if on Monday, Memorial Day, the courthouse is closed and you don't have to work. And that's true even if there's other deputies out in the county doing other things. In 2022, however, the county made a change. And they said, we're not going to do that anymore. From now on, deputies are going to have to use accrued time if they want that day off, right? So if you don't want to come to work on Memorial Day, you're going to have to burn a holiday. You're not just going to get paid. And that's going to be like any other what they call premium workday. And premium workday is important because in the 2017 negotiations between those deputy sheriffs and the county, the parties had changed the way that they do holidays. They restructured the treatment of holidays. And instead of having separate holiday pay, the value of holidays was kind of rolled into base pay. And these holidays were now called premium days. And the county basically said that under this new system, everybody's going to be treated the same. And if you're not going to work on a holiday, we're going to take it out of your premium day balance. We're not just going to pay you. The union challenged it. They didn't challenge it via a grievance. They challenged it by filing an unfair practice charge with PERB, which is why this is a PERB decision. And the union alleged that this was an unlawful unilateral change in a term and condition of employment. The employer went and they made a change. They didn't bargain with us. We certainly didn't consent to this change. That's a unilateral change in a term and condition of employment. And the union was successful. And here the PERB found that the past practice was indeed enforceable, even though the contract language had changed. It wasn't just the contract language was silent. The contract language had changed around the area of holidays. But PERB found that there was a past practice because there was no evidence on the record that the change in the contract language was intended to eliminate this longstanding past practice. That's important. When we look at past practices that continue over multiple rounds of bargaining, that's important, right? Every time you go through bargaining and the practice doesn't change, it gets like baked in more and more and more. And if you're going to change that practice, if one party or another wants to negotiate that practice away, that had better be very, very, very clear. Courts, arbitrators, hearing examiners are going to be loath to conclude that a party has waived a past practice without there being really clear evidence. And in this particular case, on these facts, the PERB determined that the contract language is ambiguous and that both sides had a really clear understanding of how holidays for courthouse folks would work. And that went back decades. And witnesses for both the county and the union agreed that that practice existed. Like nobody denied that there was a practice. But the court determined that the new contract language didn't clearly state that we were going to change the way holidays were doled out at the courthouse, that the language didn't provide clear notice to those employees that their longstanding holiday benefit was ending. And so the court determined that notwithstanding the county's argument that they had bargained that right away, they didn't do so clearly. And the courthouse deputies kept their paid courthouse holidays. So it's an interesting look at where a past practice was enforceable, and it was enforced even in the face of an alleged change to contract language that at least was intended, maybe by one side, to negotiate something away. Listen, the English language is tough. I get it. That's why you have lawyers, but you got to try to spell it out and make your intentions as clear as possible. Hey, let's go to New Jersey and talk about the flip side of this case, or it's at least a past practice case that went another way. And this has to do with overtime, speaking of wage and hour issues. And this is the state troopers, the State Fraternal Troopers Association versus Division of State Police. It was decided by New Jersey's State Superior Court Appellate Division in March of this year. And in this particular instance, there's a grievance and there's language in the contract that deals with overtime. And you know what? I think it's pretty clear, honestly. It says what the overtime rate is. And employers, if always mess up what the regular rate of pay is for overtime purposes. That's why we have whole seminars on wage and hour. But in this particular instance, the collective bargaining agreement set forth a 40-hour week, 52 weeks a year, and the contract in the overtime section, it was a parenthetical, but it's pretty clear, and it says, oh, I'm going to read it for you. The overtime rate shall be base plus maintenance divided by 2,080 times 1.5, right? So base salary plus this maintenance pay they get, let's say it's like a grand a year, we're going to divide by 2,080, and that's going to be your hourly rate times 1.5. That's your overtime rate. Easy peasy, that's what it should be. All right. The problem is not every trooper works 2,080 hours every year, just given the vagaries of the schedule. Some work 2080, some work 2096, right? Some work a little less. And what happened in 2020 was when the state did the overtime rates, they used 2096, as the divisor, right? So not 2080, they used 2096. And what that did was it wound up cutting like 60 cents an hour off the overtime pay. The union filed a grievance and they said, hey, I got clear contract language. 2080 is the divisor. You cannot change it to some larger amount, even though we are going to happen to work 2096 hours this year. You can't make that change without consenting to us. It seemed like a pretty clear one. But they lost. They lost in arbitration and ultimately they lost in court on appeal, on a couple of levels of appeal. All right, why? We've got this rule when it comes to past practices and contract interpretation. And there are always exceptions, which is why guys like me have a job. But the general rule is that clear contract language is going to trump an inconsistent past practice. That's usually what we say. And so, you know, if we got a practice, where people can take vacation so long as they give, 24 hours notice, but the contract says 72 hours notice. You need 72 hours notice before you can take a vacation day. But it's routinely been 24, you're good to go. And you have a new chief that comes in and says, "Hey, I've been reading the contract," which is like their first mistake. And they say, "I'm going to change the rule." And they start denying vacation that wasn't submitted 72 hours in advance. The question is, all right, well, we have a practice of 24 hours. Is that enforceable or not? The answer to every legal question you will ever ask me or any other lawyer worth their salt will be, it depends. It's going to depend on the facts. Usually what we would say to a new chief in that situation would be, if you're going to enforce clear language over an inconsistent past practice, you're going to need to put the union on notice and say, listen, I know we've done it this other way. I'm going to start doing things by the book. And so effective January 1st or effective whatever, we're going to start enforcing the contract as written, blah, 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 blah. That's going to give you a pretty good chance of success. Again, depending on, how long that practice has been in effect and lots of other factors, but that's the good way of doing it. And that's generally how it goes. So the expectation is going to be that, well, clear language is going to trump an inconsistent past practice. Well, here, we have really clear language, right? The 2080 figure is pretty clear. So then the question is, well, what had the practice been? And this is where the union fell down. So the evidence in the case was that over the last 30 years, the state had used multiple divisors. They had used 2080. They had used 2096 before. They had used 2088 before, depending on the calendar. And so, the practice was not to comply with that 2080. And there have been numerous instances in which the divisor had changed and the union didn't do anything about it. That's a problem, right? And, I don't know what the backstory was here and if the union was completely aware of that and they were just trying to, maybe it was a game of gotcha. Who the heck knows? But we have this practice where that 2080 wasn't enforced. The arbitrator didn't just rely on that. The arbitrator found somehow ambiguity in the 2080 because it was in a parenthetical, and said, "Well, I view this as ambiguous, and I'm going to use the history to inform my interpretation." I don't know that I agree with that, but certainly if you've got a 30-year practice of doing something one particular way, and then you try to enforce what the contract says. After that longstanding history, it's going to be a problem. And it was a problem in this particular case. Part of it just has to do with the process. If, the union lost the arbitration, and so they weren't, it's tough to overturn an award on appeal. The appellate court basically said that, hey, the arbitrator's reading was reasonably debatable. And that's enough, right, to survive. So if the union had convinced the arbitrator at arbitration, they probably would have survived appeal. But it's a really interesting example of a past practice that is not consistent with the words on the page, right? And so we have two cases, where we have a longstanding past practice. We have a contract that, might have addressed the issue, and a question about whether these employees had a reasonable expectation about whether the old way, would continue. In Albany, the union won. Right, because we had that practice that was consistent for a long period of time. We had a change in contract language that didn't explicitly kill that practice, and there was no advance notice before the change. In Jersey, in the Troopers case, the union lost, probably for the exact opposite reason. We had a practice. The practice was that the state gets to decide what the divisor is. They're not just making it up. It's based on scheduled hours during the year, and that we had some ambiguity in the contract language, which in this case turned on whether the language was in a parenthetical or in the body of a paragraph. So it's pretty close. But in both instances, the rule is, in terms of best practices, is let's try to nail down what we mean in negotiations. If you got a 30-year practice of how you divide for overtime, and you want to change it, you're going to have to really provide a lot of notice. And even then it's going to be tough. Collective bargaining is not a game of gotcha. It's a game of relationships, and the party's consistency in treating an issue over a long period of time is, in the vast majority of instances, going to carry to the day. And that goes for labor or goes for management. If you're going to try to enforce language that runs in the face of a practice that survived multiple rounds of bargaining, you kind of do so at your own risk. So, two cases on the same issue that arrive at a different outcome. That's why we have lawyers. That's why guys like me have a job. And I want to thank you guys for your patience. I think this was a long one this month, but I like these cases. They're pretty interesting, at least to me. Next month, we'll be back. There's a case that I want to interview somebody about. So it won't just be me. I'm going to talk to a lawyer about a case that they won because I think it's a pretty neat case. In the meantime, I hope everybody enjoys the first month of their summer. Come on out and see us at a seminar. And if not, I'll talk to you next month. Thanks a lot.